Hello and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and today I will be speaking with Nathaniel Wood. He is the author of Becoming Metropolitan, Urban Selfhood and the Making of Modern Krakow, published by Northern Illinois Press. It's a notable book because, contrary to the dominant scholarly trends, he focuses on urban and metropolitan European identity rather than nationalism and the shaping of national identity. Nathan Wood, welcome to New Books in East European Studies. How are you doing?
Terrific. Thank you, Hugo. It's great to be talking with you.
Well, it is great to be talking with you about your book. And I guess, I like to always start by asking people about how they got to the point of writing this their book. So could you start there, please?
Yeah, my pleasure. So I guess I'm of the generation that was still, very much aware of the Cold War and then, of course, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. I was in my last year of high school. I had a wonderful high school teacher who essentially in the spring of 1990 used all the press clippings he could find from the fall of 89 to put together a course. And I took that with great interest. And then I served a two-year mission for my church in Poland. So I lived there from 1991 to 93, went back in 1995, and this was the first time I set foot in Krakow, and was just really taken with the view of the city, as I'm sure most people who go to Krakow are. But I was very interested in the turn of the century, and particularly Stanisław Wyspiański, the artist and playwright. And so when I got to graduate school at Indiana University in 96, I was very interested to see that there really weren't any books about, in English, about turn of the century Krakow. I read Karl Szorstki's Fin de siècle Vienna with interest, and then several books about Budapest at the turn of the century, and was just really surprised that there wasn't an equivalent English language book. So I wrote, a little paper about that for some graduate course. And the more I thought about it, this is also a time when, everyone in grad school and certainly in Central European, Eastern European history was, and I think generally, was steeped in nationalism theory. I spent the first couple of years in grad school just reading everything I could about nationalism and national self-identification and national identity. But I thought, I don't want to replicate Szorstki's story, even though Krakow has its Młoda Polska, its Young Poland movement, even though there is highbrow culture, I want to try and get at a middlebrow perspective. And I thought, well, what sorts of sources would help me get more, not necessarily working class, but urban perspectives on the city? I think I had just read Beth Holmgren's book about the literature and the press in Poland at this period. I was doing a seminar paper on Tygodnik Ilustrowany, which is out of Warsaw, sort of a popular literary form. And so when I went to Krakow in 1999 on a pre-dissertation travel grant, and I found these wonderful popular illustrated newspapers, I just realized that this was a rich source and it was ready to be tapped. So that's, I think, the basic storyline, at least from the 1990s, of the origins of the book. A love of the turn of the century Krakow when I was there, an interest in writing a history of that period, but then a decision that I didn't want to tell the same story as Szorstki, and I wanted to try and come at it from a different perspective, a popular middle-brow sort of perspective. And once I started reading these great stories of Woman Leaps from Window, Faithful Dog Follows, and hilarious stuff like that, but also fears about modern urban life, I realized that the national story wasn't as prominent as I think one would think. And that's how I got this idea to stress. This is, of course, straight from all the nationalism theory, Benedict Anderson's sort of print capitalism, but interestingly, I thought that the first person plural, the community identity that was most clearly being formulated was actually an urban one, a metropolitan one, and not as much a national one. And I realized that this could be a very interesting argument in light of all the other scholarship about nationalism.
Well, I think it was a very brave leap. Having lived through that time myself and gone down the nationalism path, I mean, it must have been very hard to say you're not going to talk about it explicitly. Did you run into any people along the way who said, you've got to say more about nationalism as you did your original research?
Absolutely, yeah. And I still remember, actually, in my dissertation reading group, several of my colleagues saying, okay, just because you are stressing a new way of looking at things doesn't mean you can ignore nationalism and self-identification. And to be sure, the national self-identification is crucially important in this period and in this place. And it would be disingenuous of me to say that it's not present in sources. It's just that it wasn't the major storyline, particularly doing research the way I chose to do, which was to sit at the library and read these newspapers more or less in chronological order. And it was a real time-consuming technique, but it was delightful to follow essentially what was happening exactly a century before as I sat there in Krakow in 2001 and read through these popular illustrated newspapers. And particularly if, as I chose to do, if I focused on the Daily Chronicle section of the newspaper, which in Novinitla Vshistkich was called So Swychach v Mieście, or what's the word in town? What does one hear in town? There was very little emphasis on nationalism and much more on either local or, as I came to find, also what we might call interurban issues. You know, what's going on in other big cities and sort of what sorts of conclusions could readers draw from that?
Well, yeah, it sounds like a lovely way to spend your research time. My own experience was actually, it was sifting through everything to go to the things that were talking about nationalism. It is a pleasure to sit down and read these other articles that came along. And why don't you, the book is called Becoming Metropolitan, The Urban Selfhood and the Making of Modern Krakow. Why don't you lay the groundwork for, tell us a bit about Krakow. Why did you, had you already decided to start, at this time because of the newspapers or, what about, Krakow has an interesting history as it is in the 19th century, over the long 19th century as it is. Could you elaborate that and also position it a bit in the broader Galician context?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as I acknowledged in my sort of biographical background, I did come to Krakow because of my interest in the city itself. But as I started to articulate this issue of becoming metropolitan, I realized that Krakow is a great place to do this because it's not a prototypical big city. So in the Polish case, one should go to Warsaw or Łódź, which was the Polish Manchester, where there was all sorts of textile manufacturing. If one wanted to get a, sort of stereotypical industrial city, a big city, well, go to Warsaw, which is 800,000 people at the turn of the century and almost a million by the Great War. In Galicia itself, of course, Warsaw is not even the capital city. Lemberg, Lviv has that distinction. So the fact that I was finding so much folk interest in modern urban identity, urbanization, and what they often would call Europeanization or European civilization, struck me as really telling because I felt like, okay, if I can show that in this city, Krakow, which is today even sort of revered for its role as a center of Polish national identity, a place where the past is so dominant, unlike other Central European cities, Polish cities, Krakow wasn't destroyed during the war. It still has its architecture from its real heyday, which of course is the late medieval and sort of early Renaissance period, when it was the capital city of the Polish kingdom and then later the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So Krakow has a history of being a city that looks to its past, not to its future, that sort of reveres its past. And I thought, wow, what if I can show that even in a place like this, modern global culture has a huge influence? Well, maybe then it's a good argument. It's worth noting. 19th century Krakow has, you know, the experience of the partitions of Poland in the late 18th century, then is the Free City of Krakow as a result of the Congress of Vienna. For a while there, it's the lone semi-free pocket of what's left of this huge Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Then 1846, there are the uprisings there that take place where there are both nationalist uprisings, but also peasants who are slaughtering their landlords in the countryside and the Austrians, in many respects, you could say, capitalize on that. And so for the middle of the 19th century, Krakow is now being taken over by the Austrians. It's at its nadir. Population is down. There's a huge fire. And then 1866, throughout Galicia, the Austrian monarchy generally, there are these new laws that give cities greater autonomy. And so Krakow is now governed by local Krakowians. Polish language schooling, government is much more prominent. And in the Polish historiography, this becomes sort of a little heyday where Krakow can be the center of Polish national identity. Patrice Dabrowski has written about this period in her book, Commemorations and the Shaping of Modern Poland, where she talks about how there are all these commemorative events to sort of bring the nation together, both on multiple class levels, transcending the old definition of Polish nationalism, which of course was that of the nobility, and creating a new modern nation through commemorating, say, Mickiewicz, the bard, poet, or the finding of relics of bones of old Polish kings, or...
If I may interrupt there.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about Dabrowski's book is that she actually chips away at the notion that Krakow is obsessed about their history, because they don't even know about these bones. The discovery and, we should care about the Wawel. It's sort of a realization of the late of the discovery of the bones in 1869, if I recall the year correctly.
This is the invention of tradition. It's going on everywhere in this period. And what's great about Patrice's book is that she, on the one hand, she's reifying the narrative, but on the other hand, she is very, very sophisticated about how she shows how messy it was. And I think that's what you're pointing to. You know, people didn't really know what to do with this. They know what kind of past they wanted to commemorate. So, in effect, they were creating that past with these commemorations. And some of the people you would think would be supportive were actually kind of wary. The Steinschicks, the Steinschütze, this conservative, loyal faction, loyal to the Habsburgs, they were really nervous about this commemorative impulse. And so it's great to see in Patrice's book, she does what I've called in my reviews of it, this sort of Geertzian, a la Clifford Geertz, thick description, where she really shows how messy it was, how the peasants are jockeying for their aims during the commemorations, how the Liberal Democrats, how the Nationalists, how the Conservatives all sort of try to make the most out of the commemorative impulse. So it's not so straightforward as this national or nationalist history would have us think.
Speaking of invention of tradition and Krakow in particular, anyone who goes to Krakow or and really has spent time listening to Polish radio is familiar with the Hegnal, which is this beautiful horn piece that's played on the hour.
Yes.
From the top of the
Mariacki
Church, the Mariacki Church.
St. Mary's Church, yes.
And it is a representation, a commemoration of a trumpeter who was sounding the alarm against the Tatars invasion, and we're talking here medieval history, 1241, I think. And he gets shot with by an arrow.
Yeah, struck in the throat, the story goes. Yes.
Right. And I have, as a historian, I became very suspicious about this as something that has been going on since 1241, more or less. And I was wondering if you had any knowledge about when the Hegnal was invented, or was it really a whole medieval holdover? Do you know?
I don't know. Sorry.
That's okay. I can't
help you there. I agree. It's an interesting question. I think it does occur through the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
I know someone who's working on the Free City of Krakow. It would be interesting to ask. He's doing a PhD student doing that. It would be interesting to ask if he knows that it's going on. You know, maybe with a little sleuthing we could figure it out, but it's not something I know immediately.
Yeah. I do think that with sleuth, it would be at the very least a great article for someone to work on at some time. And it just goes to show there are things out there for people who are aspiring to do history. And there's plenty out there of material to do interesting pursue interesting questions with.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in correspondence with a young he's from New York, who is interested in sort of political violence in Krakow at the turn of the century. And I clued him into a story that I found in the press of someone who was assassinated right next to St. Mary's Cathedral in broad daylight. And he went and did research on this recently and has written some brilliant stuff. So it's you're right. There's plenty to be done. Plenty for us to figure out and great stories still to be told. This was one that wasn't so much part of my narrative, so I didn't include it, but it ended up being
central. I think you do mention that there was an assassination.
Yes.
You don't go into detail, and
yes.
Was actually wondering if I was going to hear more about that. Again, your narrative works fine without going into detail, but it certainly perked my interest.
It's a crazy story. That this guy... Well, basically, that the press sort of vacillated back and forth on whether or not it was ethical that this man had been assassinated.
Who was it?
Was he a spy or not? And so, yeah, it was called the Rybatsky murder, I think, and I don't remember if Rybatsky was the murderer or the victim. I don't have that sort of fresh in my recall right now, but. Yeah, it's a very interesting case, and I can point you to the young historian from New York who's working on this. Zach Mazur, I think, is his name.
Maybe we'll have him interview him in a couple of years down the road here. That would be a delight
great.
To learn more about it, and I don't want to take you out of your story. But it does stand out because, the big assassination in Galician history is the assassination of... Viceroy
Potocki. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and to a certain extent, as I think you've talked about in other places, the assassination of Empress Elizabeth.
Yeah, and Larry Wolf wrote a brilliant about that in the American Historical Review. Really wonderful about that. And in a way, Larry has done the Shorsky and story for us in that article.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also in his book, his award-winning book on Galicia. So in that article, Larry writes about Empress Elizabeth's assassination and the way that it was covered in the newspaper CHASS, which is very conservative, the one that was supported by the Steinschick faction. I, on the other hand,
by the way, why don't you talk a bit about the Steinschicks? Just for our, you know, there are plenty of people out here who may not have ever heard of them. I mean, the history, of course, Steinschick is the legendary court jester who always told the truth. Talk about the Steinschick movement, where it fits into Polish political thought.
Well, just in its simplest contours, and that's all I really feel qualified to talk about, this is part of the way that Polish nationalists shift in the 19th century. How to approach the state, what attitude to have toward the state. And in Krakow, you have a conservative school of historians and also these editors associated with CHASS, this conservative newspaper, who realized rather early vis-a-vis the Poles in other partitions that perhaps cooperation and being loyal is the best move rather than the stereotypical Polish response, which is kind of insurgency and revolt. That's also, of course, an invented tradition. But in the case of the Steinschicks, there's a deliberate decision to be loyal to the Habsburg state and to work from within, education, just promoting society. In Warsaw, this is associated with the positivists, those who take the name from August Comte, and the idea of small-scale work. So rather than, because, several times in the 19th century, efforts at insurrection were partially put down. And the lesson that was learned from this is rather than trying to fight the partitioning powers, perhaps we should quote until we can sort of improve society from within, and maybe our options will be better later on.
If I may add one thing, that's also associated with them is a notion of the strong state, that the anti-state rhetoric of the Szlachta, the Polish nobility, the notion that we're more important, that our ability to make decisions is more important than a strong state, was something they were also highly critical of, which is why they liked one of their justifications for supporting the Habsburgs was, here is a strong state, and we need the authority of a strong state to move forward.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to read CHASS in comparison to the kinds of papers that I read much more of. When there was an incidence of police brutality on the Rynek, the main square, market square in Krakow, the popular illustrated press took the side of the people. So the kinds of papers I was reading took the side of the people, and CHASS invariably took the side of the state and sort of defended the status quo. And so I saw this in several instances. And in the book, I use editorials from CHASS to represent alternative attitudes toward some of the things that are going on in the modernization and urbanization of Krakow. So this is a period when you have dramatic change in just 15 years. Running water, electric streetcars, the cinema, sports teams, popular illustrated newspapers. People buy meat from Argentina that comes on refrigerated ships and to Trieste and then up on the train all the way to Krakow. This is a moment where attitudes and clothing styles change, where thousands of people are pouring into an overcrowded city and trying to make their way in a new environment and sort of a new way of understanding the world. And CHASS is very suspicious of this. They don't want Krakow to become greater metropolitan Krakow. They're against the rapid modernization of the city, and they oppose the city mayor, Julius Leo's efforts to create Greater Krakow.
Although I think Leo starts out as a Stanchik, doesn't he?
That's exactly what I was going to say. He was one of these conservatives, and he sort of sees the writing on the wall before many of his contemporaries, and he is a vice president. Krakow had a president and a vice president as their municipal leaders, so what we might call a mayor and a vice mayor, and or deputy mayor. Excuse me, and Leo is the deputy mayor as a conservative, as a Stanchik. And then when he can tell that universal suffrage, male suffrage, of course, is going to pass in the Habsburg Empire, and sort of sensing this new change in perspective, he switches parties and becomes a liberal Democrat and becomes the city mayor and... he's still, you know, conservative in some of his perspectives, but he's definitely forward thinking. And like many of the mayors in other Habsburg cities, including Vienna and Budapest, he recognizes the need to appeal to the petty bourgeois citizens and not just to the financial or other elite.
Leo, was he a plebeian? Plebeian background. I mean, I see him in, as the way you describe him, as someone who probably had some similarities in perspective with another Stanchik, Bobzinski, Mikhail Bobzinski, who becomes the viceroy of Galicia, and also is a modernizer in a way and moves to include the peasant party, for example, in the Polish club.
You know, I've read Leo's biography, and I don't know that I would say that. Well, I mean, it really is fascinating that, and this is a little factoid I note in the book, that of the six mayors of Krakow in the period from 1866 to the Great War, only one of them has a sort of prototypical, stereotypical Polish last name. Many of them have sort of Czech or German sounding last names, or even a Ukrainian sounding last name. And that, I think that says something about the fact that national and ethnic identities are not one-to-one correspondences. And two, that this is the way cities long functioned in this part of the world. In the case of Leo, if memory serves me correctly, his father came to Galicia to be a manager in the salt mines at Bielicka from, I think, Moravia. And so his background, as best I know, is sort of Czech Moravian. But of course, by the turn of the century, he feels himself very much to be a Polish patriot, but also a Habsburg. And I think, you know, people had multiple identities. And one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to challenge a storyline that sees the national as being successful, because people didn't know that there was going to be a Polish state, and the outcome of World War I, which resulted in the creation of a Polish state after 123 years of one not existing, has meant that historians of the 19th century have tended to tell a teleological story, one that sort of gets us to Polish, a Polish city or a Polish state. And I just, reading these papers, I was convinced that really wasn't the way many people were seeing things. Of course, there were Polish patriots who were hopeful that there would be a Polish state. Of course, there were Polish nationalists who were saying, you know, don't buy German products or fomenting these new national ideas. Yes, the sorts of things that Brian Porter Schutz has written about in his first book. But that's not a major storyline in Krakow.
I think that's, yeah, A, it's not a storyline in Krakow. I'm more so in Lviv, Lemberg than it is in Krakow. But certainly, and even if as someone who didn't even, without reading your book, that's something that stands out from what I do know. And reading your book, it only verifies that more, and it really is this issue, getting back to what you were describing before, so wonderfully encapsulate in your title, Becoming Metropolitan. I mean, you've talked about the issue. And when you said Greater Krakow, I think we should say this means, as is happening all over the world.
That's right.
The creation of larger city conglomerations of neighboring areas.
Yeah, I mean, urban governance just doesn't work very well when you have a tax levied every time you cross some sort of putative barrier between this little suburb and that little suburb, and when you don't have a unified metropolitan police force. So this is a story that's pioneered, as in much of urban history, in London, right, with the creation of metropolitan government, metropolitan policing in London, and of course the best example for Krakow, but not the only, is the creation of Gross Wien in Vienna, Greater Vienna, where the incorporation of these surrounding districts is achieved in 1891, if I remember correctly. And it was very interesting to go to the archives and read the studies that were done by these municipal authorities. And they were very well informed as to how this process was taking place in many, many European cities. Of course, again, their closest model was Vienna, but they were attuned to new ideas in urban theory. From the English, of course, the whole idea of a garden city. Mm-hmm. This was very interesting to Poles, I'm so sorry, that sort of undermines my argument, to Krakowians, right? And they thought that, hey, perhaps the fact that we don't have much industry here could be an advantage. We could have a garden city model where we have green space and neighborhoods with villas, single family or duplex type homes, and we can do urban planning that in some respects skips some of the nastiness of 19th century industrialization. I should say, just for viewers, listeners who don't know, Krakow was not an industrial city in large because of the partitions. It was the fact that it was cut off from its hinterland, and because it was occupied by the Habsburgs in the middle of the 19th century. And so in a period when other cities are tearing down their city walls, I mean, this is quite famous in Vienna, the creation of the Ringstrasse, in order to promote urban growth and development. In Krakow, fortifications are actually being erected because this was a garrison town. Krakow was at the intersection of the three partitions, and the Habsburgs wanted to have a military force there. And so this really put a brake on commercial development. And I have some great little anecdotes in there where, you know, this village mayor says, that some Moravian came here last fall wanting to build a factory. And I told him, hey, you're welcome to build a factory, but this is the wall zone. And if the Habsburgs tell you that it has to be torn down, I can't do anything about it. So it was a real break on business. And the process of creating Greater Krakow in the beginning of the 20th century, the period that I'm writing about, was explicitly an effort to put the fortifications further out from the city to maximize sort of economic opportunities in this area, including the creation of a canal that would connect, believe it or not, the Vistula with the Danube, and then eventually with the Black Sea.
Interestingly, the city walls in Lemberg, Lviv, were actually torn down in 1777.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's part of the Austrian efforts to, sort of demonstrate mastery. And so in the early 19th century, they expand across the Poltava River, the basically which you can't see anywhere if you go to
Right.
If you it's pretty much
underground.
Again, which was considered an engineering feat at the time, although there are some Ukrainian environmentalists who want to see the Poltava live, although the descriptions of what the river was like in the mid-19th century don't make me want to necessarily say it was pretty smelly, and of course sewage was flowing there, and I don't know if they changed that when they covered it up. I don't know. But that's, again, that's another city's
sewage ends up being an important story here in Krakow as well. I write about the huge benefit of running water, how few people had indoor plumbing and could take baths at home, and also how the night carters would still have to sort of take the foul effluvia out of the city by cart and dump it in pits outside of the city, and also how the sewage would go straight into the Vistula, so that people in some of those neighboring communities across the river had a very different picture of Krakow than the Krakowians might have had themselves about its own sort of beauty if it was belching this foul effluvia into the river. But this is all, I think, part of an Enlightenment attitude toward sort of urban living. This idea that we decry filth, but it's in the hopes of overcoming it. Mm-hmm. One of the earliest kinds of articles that I focused on in my research was where I saw the trope gritty, and it was usually a term that was negatively used. Because people were afraid of becoming a big city. They were afraid of moral and literal filth, particularly the moral filth, the idea that women were sexually susceptible in the big city and that people's morals went down when they lived in big cities. This is, very common European, and I'm just European, but in this time, very common trope. But what I argue in the book is that people still don't ultimately abandon hope that something can be done about it. They complain in large part because they still believe in modern European civilization. They still believe that good governance can succeed and that people, I'm sorry about the telephone, people can still have a cleaner and better place to live.
Go ahead, Hugo.
I was going to say we could put it on pause for a second, but you get to this point though about interurban matrix,
yeah,
and about civilization, and both those together. I mean, and this gets to what you said. They'd really researched what was going on in other cities, whether it was Paris or London. Forgive the provincial interest. Does New York come into that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a great couple of stories in there that I remember. One in which a young newlywed couple from Krakow goes to New York and writes back a full-page article about their experience being in this soaring modern metropolis with skyscrapers and ferries and airplanes and streetcars and things like that. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I became convinced as I read these newspapers that there's something very interesting going on, and it's what we today call globalization. At the time, I think because European civilization had such power and prominence, there was an awareness that sort of Anglican or European civilization was the dominant paradigm. And, one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to point out that even if people of the day may not have been so aware of what was going on in a little place like Krakow, it doesn't mean that Krakowians weren't connected to this sort of modern, urban, civilized world. They were dancing the same dance steps that were being danced in Boston or London or Paris. And they were listening to some of the same things and watching the same cinema. They were reading about Jack the Ripper type attacks that occurred in New York or London or Berlin or even in Little Krakow. They were part of this new global urban civilization.
And they're making comparisons too, aren't they?
I mean, yeah, and people, they increasingly are dressing in similar ways. I mean, I love the image on the cover of the book where you see these petty bourgeois couple out for a stroll, and they could be anywhere. The background gives it away as Krakow, but the foreground, it could be in any city sort of setting. And I think that this says something about this sort of 20th century modernity as it spreads across the globe. And
for our listeners who don't have the capacity to have the book in front of them, like, of course you can go to Amazon and pull up the picture, but there's also a little flower girl who of course is impoverished but also wearing clothing that, you know, she could easily have been wearing in Berlin or London. Though in the background, not only do you have the Siknitsa, which is the sort of center of the market square, mm-hmm. once a clothing market, but you also have a peasant family in the background. Or
that's right. They're wearing the Krakowian style.
Yes, and then some men looking like they're wearing some kind of Polish-styled military uniforms, but then, of course, that would be Austrian, but I think they're wearing them as Poles.
Yes, very much so. And there's an elderly Jew walking with him. I have an article coming out in Urban History this year in which I analyze this picture. And I talk about the mythic vision of Krakow. And so one of them is the Krakow is the Polish Athens or Polish Mecca, in which it's a national a shrine, a place where people come to worship the nation and sort of revere its monuments, its historical monuments, and its meaning in terms of national identity. The other I call the Little Vienna on the Vistula, which was a term that was used at the time, sort of a recognition that Krakow was very much a Habsburg city and was part of the Habsburg Empire, and people participated in customs and attitudes of the metropole. I mean, they had their great theater. When I lived in Krakow, just a little side note, I'll get back to this picture. In 2001, my wife and I went to the various opera houses in Prague and Vienna and Budapest, Lviv. And of course, they're very similar. This is part of a similar culture, the cafe culture that's still present in Lviv and not as developed in other sort of East Ukrainian cities is also part of this connection to this Habsburg identity. And in this picture on the cover, you see the gendarme and the soldier wearing their Habsburg uniforms. So the background certainly defies the myth of the Polish Athens with its historical monuments, with people wearing their clothing that gives them away sort of their identity. And you'll note that they are kind of keeping to themselves. The Polish nobility are all talking to each other. The Jew is by himself. The peasants are by themselves. Mm-hmm. The officers are by themselves. But it's a foreground where you have the urban story going on. You have an automobile. You have tram lines. And you have a barefoot boy, in addition to the barrel who's selling flowers, a barefoot boy who's peddling the very kinds of newspapers that I read in my research for this book, in a study of a popular illustrated press, and this petty bourgeois couple out for a stroll. And so that's why I have the gerund in the title. It's becoming metropolitan. This is a process in which a city that, and cities always have multiple meanings and multiple identities, but I think one of the stories that hadn't been told and was certainly worth being told was the one that I try to tell in this book, which is this process of urbanization and modernization and being connected to a larger European or even global urban culture.
I guess the thing that keeps on coming back to me as you talk about this is the paradox that Krakow is in some ways more metropolitan and becoming metropolitan more quickly than its much larger capital, Lemberg. The Boulevard Press comes later. paradoxically, the town that's known as historically being the more democratic as opposed to conservative. And the Boulevard Press comes later. The fact that, in some sense, I think that one wants to be careful about how much one emphasizes the homogeneity, because, as you mentioned, there are a lot of different groups living in Krakow. But the fact that it was so clearly Polish dominated in some ways made it easier for it to be Habsburg than in Lemberg at this time, or Lviv, where there is a competition increasing about for the votes of the working class, and also between of the Poles and the Ukrainians.
I agree with you. I think that it, to some extent, Krakow is less nationally volatile, precisely because it's so clear that there are just two major stakeholders, the Poles and the Jews, and the Krakowian Jews are pretty well represented in politics in Krakow. And I think the fact that Lwów Lemberg has a triangular relationship between Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews makes the dynamic there much more complex. I would say that, of course, Lemberg is still more of a big city than Krakow. I'm sure. And it does actually have popular illustrated newspapers slightly before Krakow. Wiek Nowy is their boulevard newspaper. And basically, the story of the Boulevard Press in Austria is very directly traced to the elimination of the stamp tax. And so 1900, the Kroningszeitung is first published in Vienna on January 1st. I mean, the first day where this stamp tax is gone, and you're allowed to sort of sell papers without having them stamped ahead of time. And costs can go down, and then you can reach a urban market. And then a year later, Wiek Nowy, or the New Century, debuts in Lemberg.
I've missed that entirely, because you had the Gazeta Poranna and Wieczorna a few years later.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I was thinking of as the parallel to the ones you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. So, and then Kuryak Krakowski starts in 02 to sort of be a local competitor to Wiek Nowy, which is being sold in Krakow from Lemberg. Hmm. I would say that you're still right that the Illustrated Press takes off. It does much better, I think, in Krakow. Noviny dla Wszystkich, my primary source, and then Ilustrowane Kuriozodzienne, IKAC, as the Poles call it, or IKC, as it's most frequently seen in my book. They go on, it goes on to be the pair sort of popular illustrated newspaper, even in the period, and sort of a huge press empire is centered in Krakow instead of in Warsaw because of the legacy of the popular illustrated press in Krakow. So it definitely is most successful there. And again, I agree with you. I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that you don't have as much political radicalism in Krakow because things are more stable in terms of the politics. And Lemberg is, above all, a Habsburg city, but there is still a lot of sort of national competition. That's my take on it.
Yeah, and of course the Ukrainians don't even manage to get a popular newspaper out, which gets to a point that I think is key here to the more general story. When we talk about nationalism and we talk about, you mentioned Benedict Anderson's talk of print capitalism, and yet the newspapers in Galicia, until you get this Boulevard Press in Krakow, are not really money makers. It's hard to talk about it as capitalism.
Mm.
I mean, that's one of Roman Spurlock's lines.
Yeah. Well, and going back to Anderson, brilliant work, of course, pathbreaking and still very important. But when you think about it, what's the more plausible first person plural? Is it really the nation, or is it the urban community where, you know, the readers are in common? I mean, I just think it's so much easier to imagine a community in which you can walk the same space, you know, enter the same buildings and walk the same streets and cheer for the same sports teams. And so as I did this work, I felt like, you know, it's undercutting that theory, but perhaps showing ways that it could be more plausible. I mean, ultimately, self-identification is very complex, and people have multiple identities and multiple ways of identifying with different groups. But it just felt to me that the urban had really been overlooked, and that's why I wanted to stress both sort of local urban identity, and then also you mentioned my term, the interurban matrix, the sense of belonging to urban civilization, in the sense that people could read about sensational things that happen in other big cities and learn from that or try to apply that in their own experience of sipping coffee or riding the tram here in their own cities at home.
I think one of the things about that you actually may be reviving is a side of Anderson that I think was always highly original and one of my favorite parts of the book, but is about urban life, because his talk about the novel. And he uses an example of a Philippine novel, where you have multiple characters in the same environment who don't ever meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the city, is, in a sense, is the original national metaphor. I mean, and it's perhaps not a coincidence that the term we use today to speak about membership in a nation, particularly, at least a politically defined one, is citizen.
Yeah.
As we don't have a separate name for it, it's an expansion of that old time concept of all, and which included all different social classes in a way that other parts of the society were not, or the rural area where there were strict distinctions.
Yeah, we're deeply indebted to the sort of the Greek city-state model, I think, in our concepts of democracy and citizenship, right? The concept, yeah. So you're very very astute to point that out.
It's been a pleasure talking to you about this book. We don't have a lot of time left. But I'd like you, is there any particular point you want to bring out that we've not yet gotten to?
Well, if you don't mind, we didn't talk much about Chapter 5, which is what led me into my current project. So I'd be really delighted to talk a little bit about Chapter 5, which is Planes, Trams, and Automobiles. And it's the silly title that I gave it. But it was a realization that people were at first very much afraid of electric streetcars coursing down their streets, terrified of being hit, terrified of the sparks from the electricity, but that they very quickly adapted to them and soon began to complain that they were too damn slow. And I love that story. It's a story that is also told in Wolfgang Schivelbusch's book about trains, which in English is called Railway Journey. Mm-hmm. And of course it took a longer time, but it really started to fascinate me how to adapt to modern technologies. And in this case, I used it to talk about adapting to modern urban life. But my current work is on bicycles, automobiles, and airplanes in Poland from more or less their introduction mid-1880s, about 1884, 1885, to the outbreak of the Second World War. And the tentative title is Backwardness and Rushing Forward, and I'm trying to take on some of these issues of backwardness that are associated with this region and dreams and desires of being able to rush forward, and I've just decided, pun intended, to sort of seat those dreams. themes in bicycles, airplanes, and automobiles, because this is sort of the way that people, you know, what better way to rush forward than in the seat of a fast machine? So I'm looking at designers of these machines, or people who try to invent planes or automobiles, people who belong to cycling clubs, automobile clubs. So that way, the idea of being modern clearly is something that I'm fascinated with. And so becoming metropolitan now is shifting over to looking at how people approach these new machines and their own feelings about being backward and their desires to rush to the into the future.
Do you see a difference in the partitions relating to, you know, membership in those clubs?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Hugo, you know very well that those of us who do Polish history, it's for the 19th century in particular, we tend to cluster in camps, those who do partition, those who do Galicia. And there aren't many of us who do Prussia. It's been very, very interesting for me to shift from spending most of my time doing research in Krakow to being in Warsaw and to trying to make it over to the Prussian partition for a little bit of the time reading stuff from Poznań. Mm-hmm. Certainly. I would say the opportunities were best in Galicia for people who wanted to be involved in automobile clubs, aviation clubs. There was a really important aviation club in Lemberg, Aviata, that mm-hmm. was very successful. And Polish pilots were able to fly in the Habsburg Air Force and participate in international competitions. I mean, I just think that the greater freedoms enjoyed there gave Poles better opportunities in Galicia than in the other two partitions.
If I recall correctly,
yeah.
Part of the, there's a famous memorial commemorative cemetery to the Polish fighters in the 1918-19 war over Western or Eastern Galicia that's now been supplemented with a parallel Ukrainian cemetery, but that there is, the
Lviv?
Reason I'm mentioning this is in Lviv, mm-hmm. in the Lukaczewski cemetery. But what I mention it is because there's a monument to pilots specifically who fought and lost their lives. Just like mentioned that there. Before I let you go, I do, you know, you've told us about your next projects, which sounds wonderful and fascinating. But could you give us some thoughts about where you think and what you think a historian or wannabe historian would want to explore and what they need, what tools you feel are most important to acquire along the way?
Well, the great thing about this interview is that the internet is sort of international and global, so that I'm not only speaking to the American audiences to which I typically speak. In our case, in America, it's vital, or I guess even in the Anglophone world, it's vital that we learn the languages, and that's the biggest hindrance for bright young students who come to my office and tell me how much they want to study European history. It's the lack of linguistic ability that prevents them from being able to bring some of their original and important insights and questions to bear. So I've listened to some of your other podcasts. I particularly enjoyed the one with Timothy Snyder, and I recall he made a similar point that aspiring historians of this region need to learn perhaps the language of the occupying powers in the area, at least one of them, so Russian or German, and then a language of at least one of the groups there. And so I feel very fortunate that I learned Polish living in the country, and then went back and did and studied it more at university. And have tried to pick up some Czech and some German and studied some French. I'm not very confident in any of those other languages, but at least I have Polish down well enough, as Jay Winter has said, to get the jokes. And he talked about the cultural history requiring someone who knows a language well enough to get the jokes, and that it's very hard to master multiple languages sufficiently to get the jokes. And so one of his arguments is that we also need to be thinking about collaborative history, ways that we can work with our colleagues to do comparative history. And that was a very formative moment for me in graduate school when he came and spoke about cultural history. As our listeners probably know, Jay Winter is most famous for his terrific scholarship about the First World War. Mm-hmm. So I think language ability and getting over there. You have to spend time in whatever region it is you want to study. You need to live in the area for a while and have a sense for the contemporary culture and layout, at least, in order to ask, I think, good historical questions. But one of the real benefits of being, in my case, an outsider, someone who, as I always joke with the Poles, when they ask me, well, how did you come up doing this? You know, I always say, well, unfortunately, I have no Polish heritage. That's not my background. But I'm also asking different questions and trying to look at Polish history in a different way. Maybe it's because I'm an American that I don't always want to focus on the same sad stories.
Sure.
That are very vitally important. And I, of course, teach them in my classes, but I'm trying to ask different questions perhaps that help me understand myself about just living in this modern world, but in a place like Poland, where I think they're rich and even more interesting.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure talking to you, Nathan, about your book, Becoming Metropolitan.
And thank you, Hugo.
I look forward to seeing more work from you in the future. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks kindly.
This has been a discussion with Nathaniel Wood about his book, Becoming Metropolitan. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, with New Books in Eastern European Studies, and we'll be back next week with another discussion with another author. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.